Hey, this is Garth. Welcome to another episode of Psych Sessions. This is episode 18, where Eric and I had the chance to sit down with Charles Brewer of Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. And this is another special episode, Eric.
It's sponsored by the Society for the Teaching of Psychology, STP, APA Division 2. And we're so thankful for their sponsorship. We want to especially thank the current president, Sue France, and past president, Ken Keith, and the executive committee for sponsoring our trip out here. They saw the value in having an interview with Charles as part of the podcast series, and we're so appreciative of them. Also, we know that Charles's daughter, Stephanie, was in on the planning as well. I know Mark Ware did some phone calls and perhaps some emails with Charles. And this podcast, actually, for the first time in our podcast history, has a special guest host. It's Dr. John Batson from Furman University, who was a student of Charles when he went to Furman, and then later on became a faculty member, colleague of Charles, and now is a dear friend of Charles, and who regularly visits Charles, where Charles lives now in an assisted living facility here in Greenville. And so we just want to generously thank people here at the top for all that they did to make the interview possible with Charles.
This is our second week in a row of being able to interview some renowned teachers of psychology. Last week was Bill McKeachy, and this episode is Charles Brewer. It's been unbelievable to sit down with these two men back to back.
It's really remarkable, and actually they speak fondly of each other as
really
well.
Do.
I mean, so Bill, when we talked to him, spoke about Charles's good work, and when we spoke to Charles, Charles told us about a month that he spent in Michigan learning, or it might have been a summer, where he's learning from Bill McKeachy and marveled and was admiring how Bill taught 1,200 students at a time at the University of Michigan and large introductory to psychology courses. And so, you know, I guess I didn't realize just how much of a mutual admiration society there was going on there, because I guess I didn't see the two of them together very often in my own slice of my career. They're 10 years apart. And so right now, as we record this, Bill's 96 and Charles is 86.
Right. So when we get a guy like Charles Brewer on record, what do you think that means for the teaching of psychology?
Well, the people who got to know Charles, whether it be through his 12 years as editor of Teaching of Psychology, the journal, whether it was through his work at AP Psychology as a reader and a table leader, whether it was through APA governance, board of directors, you know Charles as the character, you know Charles as the stickler, the amazing mind, the writer, the editor. But when you peel away that surface, you find an amazing gentleman. You find I don't want to call him a marshmallow. I don't want to take away anything from that intellect, but you find a very sweet Southern gentleman. And so someone who cares deeply about his students and will do any antic in his classroom to make sure that his students learned the material of the day.
There were moments in this interview where I just felt like I was in the presence of greatness when it came to teaching.
Well,
that this guy, there was something in the room, something he knew that I have, maybe you know it, but I have yet to learn as kind of an earlier career person.
Well, you can imagine this very, very formal looking, formal sounding, formal appearing person, wanting to teach the principles of shaping in the learning course, and yet willing to get up on the science countertop and bark like a dog because his students have tried to shape him to do that. I mean, it didn't matter. He would do anything to help his students learn. And I think when you listen to the interview, when you listen to the podcast and you hear the 7 to 7, 7 days a week, whether that's hyperbole or not, I think that's one of those examples of he would do just about anything to help us.
And you're referring to his work, right? 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. That was his claim, right?
Right. And so I think you're going to find all kinds of nuggets in the interview as you go through. And we certainly enjoyed our time with that. And the neat thing about having one of his colleagues, John Batson, with us is that John was a nice memory prompt because John was in the room for a lot of that after Charles got the Furman. And so that was lovely.
Yeah, he asked some really great questions that we might not have come up with just because we don't know him for, you know, decades.
I mean, we don't know his Furman history because we're not colleagues of his as Furman. I mean, I would see him at the AP reading. I would see him at the APA convention. I never saw him on his home campus.
Right. So I've heard stories about him before, and I've got to say they came to life when we were with him. It was a very similar situation. We were with him in his residence at assisted living facility here in Greenville, and the stories that he told, he was so animated. I actually, while we were doing the interview, I thought, oh, I wish people could see his face as he is saying right. this right now. You know, there's so many times where he just had such joy when he was reflecting on something.
I think you're exactly right. His blood runs teacher. And so to get to relive those moments of teaching and the joy of teaching was, I think, a lovely moment for him. And I hope our listeners appreciate, we didn't really refer to it as mentoring per se, but he credits a lot of his early teachers, and especially John Anderson, who he had introductory psychology from, as the person who he modeled his career after. And I love the linkages that we're learning as podcast hosts, because if you listen to Bridget Martin Hard's podcast, you know, she's become the teacher in the style that she has, much in light of what she learned from Charles Brewer at Furman University. So there are these generations of influence that we have as teachers that I'm not so sure we even really realize at times, but that are very important.
Yeah, it was so interesting to hear John talk about, I think it was John who was talking about how students wanted the Brewer experience. And they knew what they were in for because they were in for a rigorous class and they would still sign up. And what did he how many people did he, oh, he says it on the podcast, he flunks more than half his class.
Well, at the very beginning.
Yeah.
When he was kind of brought into the department and to kind of to make it more, just to give it more structure and to make it to beef it up, so to speak. The first time he taught, the first semester, he failed 19 out of 30 students. Nobody signs up for the Landrum experience. I mean, what an amazing tribute to Furman that students will sign up to take what they believe is the hardest professor on campus just because they're curious. And I got to believe that some students want the class some days, maybe not so much to hear about what psychology was about, but what was Dr. Brewer going to do that day in class?
Which I think he was okay with, because whatever it takes.
Whatever hook you can get him to class, he would take it, because that was a chance for him to be the teacher, for them to be the learners.
Yeah. You know, after the interview, I wrote down some reflections on the time, and three words came up for me, and one was commitment. I mean, I've never seen a teacher more committed or heard a teacher talk about such commitment. Excellence. There was this pursuit of excellence in everything he did. That comes through really clearly. Passion was the third word. And I mean, at 86, he tells these stories and they are passionate. And, you know, you got to be a passionate person to come up with your own sayings called Brewerisms.
Right. And in his room, someone had put them together. I don't know if it was for a book chapter or a newspaper interview. And at some point, we'll try to make those available to people. So, you know, things always take longer than they do. And they're just classics. So one cute thing, and I had received letters from him over the years, usually correspondence about rejections from teaching of psychology submissions, where it said, all the best from Traveler's Rest. And I just thought that was a goofy little thing, you know, the people said from South Carolina. And as we arrived to the interview, holy moly, there's actually a place, Traveler's Rest, South Carolina. And I just busted out laughing because I actually didn't think that was a real place. And so that just kind of, I don't know, that Southern hospitality, that gentleman, rigorous teacher, passionate but compassionate. And high standards
has there been a bolder teacher of psychology?
Well, self-confident for sure.
Yeah,
and self-confident for sure. And I think I'm not so sure that Bill McKeachy and Charles Brewer are bookends, but they are two examples of ways of making a contribution that are not identical. And so I don't, there's not one path to success. There's probably an infinite number of paths to success. And I'm just so pleased and proud to be in a profession where we have role models like the two of them and so many other people that we've interviewed on this podcast. We have a roster of heroes in the teaching of psychology. And I'll speak for you on this one occasion. We're honored to interview those folks.
Yeah, we definitely are. And, you know, I appreciate that you got to step into the place as the representative for about 30 seconds of Teachers of Psychology to tell these guys how much it means to us.
I should probably stop saying that, but I probably won't. Only because, you know, people need to be appreciated. They need to know it. I do think teachers everywhere appreciate what Charles Brewer and Bill McKeachy have done.
So yeah.
One thing we should warn you about, folks, is that as you're listening to the podcast, you know, we're not in a controlled studio when we do this. And so the day that we were visiting with Charles in assisted living, they're putting in new flooring outside in the hallway. And to do that, they're scraping the floors to remove the old flooring. And so we do our best with the audio technology available to us to scrub that out. But hopefully you will have some habituation quickly to those background sounds and they'll not bother you. And perhaps I shouldn't have said anything and you would have never noticed them. But trust me, if we could have gone out and asked them to stop doing their work for an hour, we would have. But hopefully you can still appreciate what you heard.
The scraping does stop near the end of the podcast. So there is some clean audio at the end, which is a little easier to listen to. But thanks for sticking with us. Well, without any further delay, here is Charles Brewer.
FU one time, FU two times, FU three times, and FU all the time.
What was it like when you took the journal from Robert Daniel? What was that transition like when you became editor of Teaching of Psychology?
Well, it was very smooth, actually. Bob had been the editor of the newsletter.
Right.
That mimeograph thing. And I had an understanding with the officers of the division. If they wanted a journal, it would cost them. And that we would be able to absorb the cost once it got a reputation and people subscribed in sufficient numbers. And it couldn't have worked out better.
Did you know him very well?
But I did not, but I got to know him as we went along. I went to his home school, the University of Missouri, I think.
Wow.
And I visited a couple of times and sort of got his perspective on it.
What was, as you remember that transition, was Teaching of Psychology very popular at the time when you inherited the journal?
The only indication of popularity we have is subscriptions.
Right.
And they increased dramatically.
I'm sure they increased dramatically under your editorial
ship. Yes, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I was going to save this, but since we're on this topic, I actually brought a couple things to show you.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Thank you. But I brought with me two rejection letters.
Oh, yes.
From Charles Brewer.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
I regret to tell you that your manuscript.
That's funny.
I also was very fortunate to publish a handful of times while you were editor.
Yes.
And those are very – actually, my first manuscript that I published in Teaching of Psychology was in 1993 while you were still editor, and I'm very proud of that.
Oh, so, wow. I'm so pleased.
But I wanted to bring those to show you that even – Those letters are from 1991 and 1992.
Yeah. Amazing.
That your signature's on there, and one of the your famous Brewerisms is on one of those letters. Something you said, something like, I apologize for the delay.
Things always take longer than they do.
Yes, sir. One of your true classics.
It was things take longer than they do? Is that
things always take longer than they do.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. So good.
In fact, I've got my brewers and posted up there. Somebody posted them up there.
Oh, my
God. Oh, I see them. Yeah.
All there in one spot.
Oh, I'm going to take a picture of that before we leave. Yeah. Now, did a student create that or a faculty colleague? Or
I think it was a joint effort of students and colleagues.
So, Charles, we can go in any order of things that you want to talk about.
Okay.
I was hoping that maybe you might tell your origin story a little bit. I've read the chapter that John and Gil wrote about you.
Which I thought was very good.
It is very good. I've read it a couple times. I read it again.
By the way, I proofread it for them.
Okay. So since John is in the room with us,
yeah.
How many mistakes were in it the first time through?
Actually, it was in good shape because they knew it better be.
Were there many split infinitives or dangling modifiers?
I think nobody at Furman, who was associated with me, escaped a split infinitive, which, by the way, is not now the no-no that it once was.
Thanks to you at Furman, I'm sure. I wanted to talk a little bit about, I read in that chapter, you wanted to be a teacher from what I read since
I can't ever remember wanting to be anything else. As a matter of fact, when we were coming along as children, we had this it wasn't a chalkboard in the present sense, but it was a thing you write on. And I would always be the teacher, and I would stand up and call on the kids. And, you know, we were 6 and 8 years old, and I did that from the time I can remember.
What do you remember about your teachers growing up?
Okay. As a matter of fact, I remember three. And I've thought about this a lot. One was Miss Laverne Kinneyway, who was our family friend and a third grade teacher. And she would encourage me, even before I was kindergarten age, to come and sit in the back of her classroom. And I did that for probably a year and a half or 2 years, because I was in love with Miss Laverne. And then I had a Ford Foundation grant. They were trying to encourage liberal arts students to go into teaching. They sent me off to Little Rock Central High School in an unfortunate period of its history. And there I was under the tutelage of another Furman graduate, Miss Emily Pinton, who was a ramrod, straight legs, pince-nez wearing. She's the only person I ever knew who wore a pince-nez. And she had her hair in a bun, and she... actually, she claims, and I can't verify this, that she satisfied all the requirements for a PhD at the University of Chicago, but she didn't get a PhD because in those days, women didn't get PhDs. I found that incredible, but I can't imagine why she would misrepresent it. From the beginning, I knew I wanted to teach. The question is, what do you want to teach? I could easily have taught history or English or philosophy. And then I took general psychology with Dr. John P. Anderson, who had his degree from Columbia University. In my high school, we didn't have psychology. So that was my first introduction to psychology. And Anderson was a debonair, wonderful, wonderful teacher. And I said, that's what I want to do.
So it was the role model that you saw. That
indeed.
You wanted to be like him.
Exactly.
So the passion for teaching was early on. Because you loved being the teacher, did you have a hard time sometimes being the student as an undergraduate or in graduate school? Was it sometimes frustrating to not be the teacher in those situations?
Not really.
Okay.
Because I knew I had to have something to teach.
Okay.
And so I wanted to learn as much as I could about how to do that.
Sure, sure.
That was never a concern, no.
All right. You were a basketball player.
I was at one point. All-state basketball.
All-state basketball. And where was that?
Watson Chapel High School outside of Pine Bluff, Arkansas.
And what position did you play?
I played forward, and I scored the points. My brother, who was 18 months younger, was the guard, and he brought the ball up, and I put it in the bucket.
It was a family affair.
Yes, it was.
And so, I'm sorry, did you say Watson Chapel High School?
Watson Chapel, two words.
And he goes on to study John B. Watson later on in his life.
Yeah.
I'm guessing the timing is, in your origin story, you served in World War II.
No, it was after World War II. And in fact, it was after Korea.
Uh-oh.
And
okay.
My military was in intelligence, and I was a chief of the Southeast Asia desk of the Psychological Warfare Center in Tokyo, Japan, for a year and a half.
Okay.
And what did that mean? That meant that we analyzed all of the radio and television output from Hanoi to try to see what was going on. And if they had listened to us, we wouldn't have got in such a mess in Vietnam, as a matter of fact.
What did you learn?
We learned that the military had it all wrong in terms of what they planned to do.
Did you enjoy that experience? Or?
As a matter of fact, I really did enjoy it because it was different from anything I had ever done. And being in Japan was, I can't tell you what a pleasure that was.
Now, did you take your wife and daughter at the time?
No, I was not married at the time.
Oh, okay. And you mentioned earlier you played basketball with your brother.
Yes.
Your brother was older.
No, he was 18 months younger.
Did you have any other siblings?
One sister who's still alive, and she comes here to visit about once a year.
Oh, that's lovely.
And she was very, very successful. She and her husband ran the Arkansas Pallet Factory.
And she's still in Arkansas?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Then, Charles, how do you make the path? I'm trying to trace the path. How do you make the path to Furman?
The path to Furman?
Yeah, so I think you made a couple of stops before you got to Furman.
As a matter of fact, I actually had a couple of master's degrees, and I said, well, I don't know if teaching is what I want to do or not. I better try this out to see if I can do it and if I like it. So I went to the College of Worcester.
Sure.
And I spent 2 years there with a wonderful, wonderful faculty. And then I went to Elmira College in upstate New York. The faculty wasn't as good, but the experience of being in a different part of the country was very, very good. And so I'll never forget that. I was being interviewed in the dean's office when the Furman dean called me and said, don't you take a job until you come and talk to us. And I said, I will respect that. So, sure enough, I came here. And for some reason, they were very impressed with my combination of research and teaching, and I think I could have said, I want to be the dean, and they would have said, okay. It was that kind of a relationship, and if you didn't know Bonner, as John did know Bonner, you would know that was very unusual for him to be so praising.
The man who hired you was I believe his title was provost at the time, I believe.
That's correct.
His name was Frank Bonner.
Frank Bonner.
And he's the one, apparently, who made that phone call to you.
That's exactly right.
And somehow had already known about you.
Yeah.
And invited you to come and then quickly made an offer to you.
And I don't know how he knew about that I was even looking for a job.
That's interesting. So you're on the job market. You're at Wooster. You're interviewing at Elmira. And somebody,
yeah,
Furman, is calling you while you're on an interview
exactly
saying,
right,
don't take that job offer. Let me talk to you first.
Yep.
And that was, I'm thinking, 1967?
Yeah.
Is that right in the ballpark?
Yep. Wow.
I was playing with some levels here, so I don't know that I heard. What was it about you? Why were they pursuing you so hard from
Furman? Lack of insight, I guess.
Okay. All right.
Well, obviously
well,
they really wanted you.
Yes, they did.
Why did they think you would be such a good fit here?
Well, because I was a good combination of research, and I'd already published research with some very prominent people, and they were actually trying to be a university. And they wanted somebody to do research, but they wouldn't keep somebody if he wasn't a good teacher.
Right.
So it was that sort of combination that they thought I might have that was so attractive to them. Do you think that's accurate, John?
I think it is. Of course, I wasn't here at the time, but
right,
I did know Frank Bonner, and I know something about the history,
right,
of the department and the university. In the mid-1960s, and until the late 1960s, the psychology department was very different than it was beginning after you arrived.
That's correct.
And what you always told me was that Bonner saw in you a way to modernize the psychology department.
Yes.
And to make it more academically rigorous.
Yes.
Because in those days, in the mid-60s, the psychology department was not what we would today call a psychology department.
No, they had two. They were actually, one was a high school guidance counselor, and one was a pastoral counselor from Columbia University. They had good credentials,
sure,
but it simply was not what Bonner wanted to do.
So coming to Furman and seeing the faculty at that point, is that the spark for your interest in curriculum?
As a matter of fact, I had already revised the curriculum at Elmira.
Oh, okay.
And they thought that was a good idea to have somebody like that because that's what they wanted to do.
Over the course of your career, you became the national expert in psychology curriculum.
That's correct.
And so, at some point along the way, you clearly became interested in that and wrote about it, and you,
yep,
were at the St. Mary's Conference. And,
yep.
And there's, I think it's in your chapter that you and Gil wrote together about burning the midnight oil.
Oh, yeah.
Rewriting, and,
yep,
you worked on the national standards for the high school.
Yep.
The first edition of that. And so somewhere along the way, that became a passion to talk about that as on a national basis, not just at Elmira.
And the reason is, at that time, more psychology departments were like the counseling thing that I mentioned than were experimentally rigorous. I mean, we went through a dramatic change during that period of time. You wouldn't recognize psychology after the change occurred.
And were you charged to do that when you came to Furman? Did they say, we want you to make this?
As a matter of fact, I have Bonner's page and a half letter. He outlines exactly what he wants me to do, and that is to get rid of the riffraff and get students to present papers at conferences, publish papers in national journals, and I did that.
So that's late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
That's actually well ahead of,
oh, yes,
of the trend. I mean, that's very common today.
Oh, yeah.
To have that, you know, a regional conference, or actually campuses have their own scholarship conferences. But that's 30 or 40 years ahead of the
trend. As a matter of fact,
we see today.
We have our own research conference at Furman locally.
Right.
And then we have the state, and then we have the regional and the national. And the idea of students going, reading a paper at a conference was simply foreign. I mean, that's just not what they were doing. Well, that changed pretty dramatically.
Now, Charles, when you came to Furman in 1967 and you were charged with changing the department, making it more academically respectable and mainstream, there were a number of changes that took place in a very short period of time.
Oh, indeed.
For instance, when you first arrived, your first students were leftovers from the so-called counseling or pastoral counseling program. Could you tell us a little bit about what you remember about those students in your
indeed
classroom?
Indeed I can. That was an unsettling period. The first semester I taught psychology here, 19 out of 30 students flunked. I never once heard a word about that being inappropriate from Bonner. I mean, he was ready for a different psych department. And I still have that page and a half letter that he wrote saying, "This is what I want you to do." And I think he would be pleased that it went well.
Now, did the word get out pretty soon that a new man was in town?
Oh, did it ever. Psychology is now different. Because then, it was for I don't mean to be unkind, but it was for the other weaker students. And that changed almost immediately.
There was a new sheriff in town. And the letter that you had from your provost was your manifesto.
That's right.
And so if 19 out of 30 students failed, that was okay because you had the provost backing.
That's exactly right. And that's why I wanted it in writing.
And that was a very smart thing to have.
So what do you say to teachers who are worried about flunking students today?
High school or college?
College.
I say, understand before you take the job what they want you to do. Do they want a rigorous, respectable department? Simple as that.
How did you hear about a Division II STP? How did you get involved in that initially?
Well, I was interested in teaching, and that was the official outlet for psychologists at the time. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, the what's that other psychology organization?
Now, I don't know. Are you playing with us? Are you actually trying to remember? I don't know, but I loved it. It's a great moment there.
It was
Association for Psychological Science.
It
was
nobody had even heard of that.
Right.
And so, as a matter of fact, I think it got started. Because people thought that Division II and the APA was getting a little bit too lax, and they wanted to be rigorous.
Right.
Is that your perception?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think the perception was APA was becoming too practitioner-oriented.
As a matter of fact, too counselor-oriented.
Right.
And I didn't want to be a handholder.
Right. And the scientists wanted to break off.
Exactly.
In 1988, that's actually what they did.
Yeah.
But that's a great segue to, you spent a lot of time, APA Board of Directors, Council of Representatives. You spent a lot of time with APA governance.
Yeah.
Why? I'm sorry. What was that like? What was that all about?
These groups make decisions frankly, I would prefer to be the one making them than this group. And I went in there to try to influence the development of the discipline. Now, that might be obtuse of me to think I could do that, but that's exactly why I did it.
Well, and I think as teachers of psychology, I think we underestimate our power sometimes. And so we needed someone like you with that confidence to go in and represent us. Otherwise, we would just kind of shy away from it.
And yes.
I think we needed that representation. Good. I think that was essential. I really do.
Charles, when you first began your involvement in Division II and with the APA governance boards, et cetera, who were some of your compatriots on those boards and in the journals? Who did you work with?
Well, I worked with Bob Daniel, the founding editor of the journal. And I actually went to his home a couple of times. And then Bill McKeachy.
Right.
McKeachy was a prince. And we don't have anybody like that anymore.
I think that's why Garth and I have been lucky in the support from STP, and that we're getting to talk to the princes.
Yeah, so what was your relationship like with Bill McKeachy over the years? What did you guys work on together?
Well, we worked on several projects. But the one thing that impressed me about McKeachy was he was at the University of Michigan, and he taught 1,200 students. And I thought, that's absurd. And then I went to visit him. And the way he did it, of course, wasn't absurd, because he'd have specialists in X, Y, and Z come in and give their lectures, and that's the only time the students would see them. But he had the groups divided up probably into groups of 15, and he had a room full of TAs, and they would literally go and meet with them twice a week, so they could ask any question they wanted to. And it seems so impersonal, but when you see it in action, it wasn't impersonal at all, because they were having conversation with 12 or 15 among themselves with a TA. And I was very impressed with how he engineered that.
What courses did you teach at Furman? I think you taught introductory psychology.
I taught
research methods.
Research methods, statistics, learning, history, and systems. All the bad courses, according to students.
Now that you have officially retired, maybe it's safe to say, did you have a favorite?
I think general psychology was my favorite.
Okay.
The reason for that was, when I first started out, psychology wasn't nearly as widespread as it is now. And I literally introduced students to a discipline that some of them had never heard of.
Right.
Like me with Dr. Anderson back at Hendricks College. Yeah. And I think that's why that was so rewarding.
What do you think... how do I ask this question? The general psychology course, why is that an important course for university students to take?
That's a very good question.
Because a lot of them choose to take it.
Oh, yeah.
It's elective, and they...
Unfortunately, a lot of them choose to take it because it's a crit course. And I'm aware that that's true. But I'd like, and I wish they would take it, because it touches on so many different aspects, and it tries to incorporate them into some sensical whole. And that's what I liked about it. Mm-hmm.
John was one of your students before.
Yes.
He was one of your colleagues.
And he's the only one in that category, I think.
The only one?
Yeah.
Was he a pretty good student?
He was a very good student, but I had to get his attention.
That's great. I'll bet, the way I felt about getting a manuscript published while you were editor I'll bet is parallel to the way getting an A from Dr. Brewer felt.
Well, not many people have had that experience.
And I can vouch for that.
Yes.
John, did you ever have that experience?
I did have that experience, I think, on one occasion.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That was a pretty good occasion.
Well, I began to take psychology, general psychology, just because some friends of mine had already been through the Brewer experience and guaranteed me that I needed to also experience Brewer as part of my education. So I enrolled, not really knowing much about what psychology was.
Like me with Dr. Anderson.
And very quickly, Brewer did indeed get my attention. And unfortunately, I did pass the course. But let's not go into any more detail about that. But I did fall in love with psychology and was enamored with Brewer's teaching techniques and with psychology and became a psychology major. And eventually, I did indeed make an A in one of Brewer's classes.
And Charles, you keep mentioning Dr. Anderson.
Yes.
And Garth talks about this at some length at times, about mentoring. That's an important, pivotal part of your life, it
As
sounds to
fact,
me.
In terms of influence, that's probably more directly influential than my actual teaching.
Right.
Because these affect these, affect these. And by the way, that may be the only immortality we will ever get. That's Henry Adams, not Charles.
Well, of course you would have a citation to, you know, you would give credit where credit is due. I wanted to ask you about how did your teaching change, your teaching style or pedagogy change from the beginning of your teaching career to the end of your teaching career?
Well, at the end, I reluctantly used mechanical devices, which weren't even available when I started. But I vowed that I would not simply be a talking head. Some teachers I know seldom see their students. And as I indicated a while ago, the TAs do all the teaching.
Sure.
Well, I tell my students, I figured it out. Every lecture that I give in here costs you $55. Was it worth it?
I actually think that's a great strategy for students when they're considering, are you going to skip my class?
Yeah.
If you're going to skip my class, you've just wasted $55.
I've used that many times.
Right.
But, of course, inflation.
Well, and Furman may be more expensive than your state university.
Believe it.
Your results
it
may
is,
vary.
Right, John? Yeah.
So I never had the privilege of hearing a talk from you, and I was never in one of your classes. If I was one of your students, what would I expect from a general psychology course with Dr. Brewer? And what would I experience in the classroom? Were you all over walking around the class?
Oh, yes. I'd be up on the desk. I'd be up on the table. I'd be doing strange things. I never mentioned this, but a student has never slept through my class. And the reason is, when I see them begin to nod off, I will call on them and call on them. And then pretty soon they get the point.
And so everything sounds like it was very intentional. Everything you did was intentional for student learning.
That's exactly right.
You were probably going to make a point.
Oh, yeah.
Physically and with your
Whether
voice.
Whether they wanted me to or not.
Right. Because I've heard from former students of yours about the way that you articulated what you wanted to say. It was very careful.
Oh, yes. I'm a stickler with the language. As a matter of fact, I tell my students, all you have to know is the language. And I really believe that, actually.
We actually interviewed one of your former students, Bridget Martin Hard. She tells a story of being in your intros, I think it might have been research methods class, and there was a line that she had to memorize, and every time you pointed to her, she had to say something. I'm forgetting it exactly, but...
It was something to do with the words.
It was something to do about the words.
All you have to know is the language.
Yes, right, and when you pointed to her, she had to say something about, it's how it's communicated, and I'm not getting it exactly right. But she remembers that to this
That's
day.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, that those
that
lessons...
That may be more important than the psychology that she learned, by the way.
I wonder how many times, and this is a good thing in my opinion, how many times your students showed up to class just to see what was going to happen.
Well, I hope it was often.
Right. I mean, maybe they didn't even look at the syllabus to see the topic, but was Dr. Brewer going to jump up on the table?
As a matter of fact, speaking of syllabus, I learned early on that you can't trust student note-taking. At one time, I looked at some students' notes. They had absolutely no relation to what I thought I'd see. At that point, I said, I will provide them with a detailed outline of what we're going to cover, and we'll cover it in exactly that way. And then they can remember these other things because they've got the information right there. And dispensing information is not what a teacher is supposed to do.
So, and maybe we've already addressed this, but I'm a student. I've got all the information in front of me. What do you do on top of dispensing information as a teacher?
Well, I jump up and down on the desk. I entertain them.
Now, Charles, you've mentioned now two or three times jumping up on a desk.
Yep.
Well, I remember on one occasion you came back from general psychology, or it might have been your learning class, and I had some feeling that something special had happened because your students were following you back to your office and laughing. And finally, I asked you, what in the world happened today? And you said, well, I wanted to demonstrate the process of shaping behavior. And so I told the students that I was going to leave the room and shut the door. And their job was to get together as a class.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember this?
I sure do.
And they had to figure out what behavior they wanted to shape in you.
Yes.
Within the confines of the classroom.
Right.
And when they had figured that out and figured out how they were going to deliver reinforcement, they were to come out into the hallway and yes. bring you back in.
Yep.
Without you knowing a thing about what they were doing. And as a psychologist, it's good at this point to remember, as Skinner and others have taught us, that the first thing you do before shaping a behavior is to get a baseline.
Right.
And in this particular case, the baseline behavior that they wanted to train was at zero. The behavior, the target behavior, was to have you get up onto the desk in the front of the room on all fours and scratch like a dog.
Oh, yes.
So how often do you think that happened before they began reinforcing? So how did they get you to do that? Well, they shaped your behavior. What kind of reinforcers did they use, Charles?
Well, they...
They clap.
That's for yes, and boo is for no.
That's right.
And they can shape. And it's amazing how quickly they can shape up pretty strange behavior.
So this is interesting because I have heard of instructors using something like this, but they'll usually make a student the one who's having behavior shape. But you put yourself out there for them to use.
Of course.
And that was a part of your practice.
Yeah, and they thought it was great. Oh, it wouldn't have been nearly as effective if I'd got some student up there. Well, they wanted to see me make a fool of myself.
I think the beauty of it, Charles, is that, you know, I am sure in the classroom you were intimidating, you were formal.
As a matter of fact, that's true.
But when you're doing that, when you're allowing yourself to be shaped and you're up there, you're being informal and you're, in that sense, you're being human and adorable.
Oh,
and so you're showing your personal side, right, while you're still the instructor, you're still the person in charge.
They
of the
know
classroom.
Who's in charge.
Yeah, but you're still showing them a really fun side,
yeah,
of yourself.
I think that's right.
And I think the message there is that you would do anything to help them learn.
Oh, sure.
Even if they're going to laugh at you or follow you back to your office that day, you didn't care as long as they were learning.
That's exactly right.
I think. Yeah.
So when you came up with something like this shaping demonstration, you obviously didn't do it on the spot. Were you thoughtfully considering every class, reflecting on what you might do, planning every moment?
Even after so many years of teaching, things always come up that you didn't expect. You see things in a new way. You think of a new example in current affairs or whatever.
Can you think of an example from your teaching career of the most unexpected thing or something that caught you by surprise? I mean, you've got a lot of years of teaching examples. Was there any big surprise that
As a matter of fact, there were a couple. I think it was on my birthday or something. They traipsed in with a birthday cake and refreshments, and I said, to hell with class. We just stopped and had a party. Were you in that class?
No, I was not in that class, but I remember that class.
Yeah.
They not only brought in a cake, but they also brought in a special guest to perform for you that day.
But yeah, it was this belly dancer. And
she danced right in front of you, indeed toward you, while the students were laughing and having such a grand time.
Yes.
Hoping that you would be embarrassed.
Yep.
But you somehow held it together. And toward the end, after she finished dancing, I think I remember you issuing one of your brewerisms. Keep your eyeballs on the data.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that...
And what I appreciate about that is that's, you know, I think that's adoration. I mean, your students, that's love and affection of your students.
That's what I like to think of.
A birthday cake and recognizing you is absolutely that. I wanted to, Charles, before I forget, I know you were involved with the advanced placement, the AP reading,
right,
for a number of years. Did you have any... from the second reading, is that where you got started, or were you at the very first reading?
No, I was at the very first one at Clemson University.
At Clemson. And so do you have any thoughts or memories or stories to tell about
the AP
reading?
Well, it was one of the best things that we ever did. And the reason is it exposed more good students to psychology. And if we hadn't got in on it, when we did, we would have lost out to biology and chemistry. I'm convinced that's true.
I don't know if you know this, but at the last AP reading we had, I think the number was just over 300,000 exams.
That's amazing.
That
when I started out at Clemson, gosh, I think there were 130 maybe or something like that.
130, yeah. I think it was 16 people.
Yeah.
I think I've seen the picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, 16 readers. There was no chief reader.
There was no chief reader.
One table.
Just one table. We all sat around. And
who was in that room? Who was reading with you? Do you remember anybody?
Oh, dear. Jane Hallinan.
I want to say maybe Randy Ernst.
Randy Ernst. Charlie Blair Broker. Those were the two high school readers.
Rob McIntyre.
Yeah.
Wow. He tells a lovely story of, I think, the first time he met you when he arrived at the AP reading. I think he got there maybe a little bit late.
Yes, he did. I remember.
And he walks into the back of the room as a high school teacher, and I believe you said something to the extent of, "Oh, they're letting high school students now come to the AP reading."
Right, I readers. Because he looks so young.
He still does. Yeah. He still does to this day. He looks young. And people still see him and call him Young Rob.
Young Rob. So, I gave him that name.
Yes, and he's young very Rob. Proud of it. He loves that. And,
that's
and,
good.
And I know for years you attended the Nebraska Symposium.
Yes.
And many people wrote to us about you would sit in the back of the room and you would grade papers and red ink, and you helped those folks. I believe there were some edited volumes that came out of that. And so, again, a lot of collaborations around the country and a lot of fond memories.
Yes.
out of
one of the
those
things
trips.
I remember as being the most unusual is the Brewer Spiral.
The Brewer what?
Spiral. Did anybody mention that?
No. Tell us.
Okay. When somebody wrote, "Perception is when," I would take my red pen and start and circle the whole damn page, and that became known as the Brewer Spiral. And so they learned quickly not to say "is when."
I just had a random thought. So when memos came from your dean or your provost at Furman, did you ever have a hard time not grading those and returning them back to the...
Sometimes I would.
to the dean or the provost?
Although Frank Bonner was an English teacher. He was a
he was pretty
dean,
good. You didn't have to correct him very often.
He was very good.
Okay. Yeah. I'm free associating now. Being editor of Teaching of Psychology for 12 years... I think I know the answer. Did that help improve your writing at all, or not so much?
Oh, not so much.
Yeah. I would imagine the editorship, you were already an excellent writer anyway.
I was already a pretty good writer.
Right.
Which is one of the reasons, I guess,
they
wanted me to be the editor.
Yeah.
We live in a time now where everything is, you know, we're trying to do evidence-based practices in the classroom. People are trying out different things. What is the best way to teach? We know that active learning is maybe something like what McKeachy was doing in small groups. That's a really good practice. Do you have advice for young or new teachers? How should they teach? What is an effective way? I know what was effective for you.
Okay. You have to decide what's best for you. There is no one way that's best to do it. You have to decide based on your personality, your interaction with students. You have to decide how it's best for you to do it. What works for me might be a complete flop for somebody else, and vice versa.
Right. So somebody was trying to be Brewer in the way that they were teaching, that could turn out to be a total flop if it didn't fit.
Oh, indeed. In fact, it probably would. Mm-hmm. Because you have to get your own style.
It would be fake.
Right.
If I was trying to imitate you, I wouldn't be very good at it, but it wouldn't be me. It wouldn't be authentic.
Now, that doesn't mean that you can't learn from watching good teachers.
Right.
I learned a lot from Bill McKeachy, but I never tried to be Bill McKeachy.
Right. So you would watch him, you'd reflect on why it was working or why it was good,
yes.
And you would wonder about what that
meant
for you.
What if I did this? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's essentially how it works.
So is reflection a big part of your process in developing as a teacher?
Yeah.
Did you walk away from classes sometimes and think, what did I do there that worked so well? Or?
As a matter of fact, that's the most frustrating thing about teaching. You never know what you're doing. And in my next incarnation, have I mentioned this?
Mm-mm.
I want to be a house painter or a bricklayer. At the end of the day, you can say, I started here. And I painted this much. I started here. I laid this many bricks. In teaching, you don't have that kind of quantification. You just hope. And with some people it works, and with some it doesn't.
Now, Charles, you mentioned, and I think it's an excellent point, that to be effective, teachers really have to know themselves or to learn about themselves.
That's exactly right.
And they have to figure out what's going to work for them.
That's exactly right.
Which means, of course, that teachers are going to make mistakes.
Oh, God, those first couple of years are just dreadful.
Could you share with us some memory of a mistake that you might have made and perhaps how you corrected it?
I probably repressed it. I'm not a Freudian, but I probably repressed it. I do recall walking out of the classroom. I can't recall a specific way, but walking out of the classroom and saying, well, I won't make that mistake again. But I can't remember now what it might have been.
You worked 7 days a week, the rumor has it, most days.
I took off Easter and Christmas.
And by the way, when we mentioned that to Dave Myers, who adores you like everyone else, it makes him feel like a slacker.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, Dave Myers, the world's leading textbook author,
right, feels
like a slacker compared to Charles Brewer.
Dave is a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
So you really did work most day, 7 days a week?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You were in the office?
Actually, I had an office at home. So I didn't have to cart everything back and forth.
And were your students able to get in touch with you any day?
Oh, yeah. They had my telephone number 24/7.
And can you tell, because you've written a great deal about John B. Watson,
yep.
You may be his official or unofficial biographer. Did you ever find any evidence in all the things that you read and all your interviews that turning his master's thesis in upside down really cost him an extra year in graduate school? That apocryphal story?
No, that's actually true.
It's true.
Yes. The question is, what does turning it upside down mean? And that's what I haven't found out. Does it mean that it's upside down? Does it mean the pages are in out of order? What does it mean? And I don't know.
Well, in Watson's short autobiography in the Murchison series,
right.
Watson wrote that the teacher had told the students that any man, and in those days it was man, at the university, any man who turned his paper in backward,
not upside down,
fail the class.
Backward.
And
then what is backward?
And Watson then wrote, by some strange streak of luck.
Yes, those were his exact words, as a matter of fact.
Yes, I managed to turn my entire paper of 17 pages in backwards. Professor Moore kept his word, and I had to stay at Furman another year, earning an A.M. degree instead of a B.A.
He never earned a bachelor's degree. Yeah.
Fascinating.
And then you wonder about why he thought it was lucky. Do you remember what happened during that last fifth year of his undergraduate career?
Well, I can't remember what you might think.
Well, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I believe his mother died during that year. And I've always assumed that he thought it was lucky to have to stay another year, because his mother had made him promise about a different career trajectory.
Right.
What was that, Charles?
She wanted him to be a minister. And as a matter of fact, John, what's his name?
Broadus
was a prominent minister here in Greenville. And she named him after that minister, hoping that he would be like him.
Wow.
How wrong she was. Brought us, yeah.
Now, Charles, when you were studying Watson in the local context, Watson grew up literally about 2 or 3 miles from where we are currently seated. when you came to Furman, you were interested in getting some of the local history about Watson, and you had a chance to interview some distant relatives.
Yes.
Do you remember who any of those were?
One was a Mrs. Thompson, whose big red brick column house is here, overlooking a cemetery. And she was very, very helpful. As a matter of fact, she had a copy of Psychology from the Standpoint of Behaviorist, autographed by Broadus Watson.
Wow.
I did everything I could to persuade her that Furman would be a much better place for that than her bookshelf. No luck.
Oh, wow.
Good.
But there was another relative also who actually did come to Furman,
yes,
on at least one occasion, and that was Watson's son.
Jim.
Jim Watson.
Yeah. And he, by the way, has made a fortune as the vice president of Wesson Oil Company.
So I have a couple questions.
Sure.
You've probably got a lot of accolades in your career, throughout your career. And this actually comes from somebody who wanted us to ask you this question, which is, what are you most proud of in your psychology teaching career? Or maybe something that you're very, very proud of in your psychology teaching career.
I never recruited a student to my class. I never recruited a student to major in psych. I never recruited a major in another subject to be a psychology professor. That just happened. Now, especially with the enrollments what they are, we have departments that literally and formally recruit majors. And I just didn't want to do that and never did.
Yeah, it seems like you had too much respect for the discipline and for the craft of teaching.
Yes.
Well, and you didn't need to. Your reputation preceded that.
Well, I think John would agree that the students learn pretty quickly when they come to Furman that if they want an easy course, it's not Brewer's general psychology course.
And you were quite okay with students knowing that
I wanted them to know. As a matter of fact, on the first day, I let them know if they hadn't read the syllabus. I let them know what it was going to be like. And I would say, believe it or not, and if this is incompatible with your expectations, you better drop this course before the sun sets today. That's part of my spiel.
And what was your expectation in that course? What were they going to do? What made it rigorous?
Having 10 alternatives for multiple choice questions would be one. All of the above, some but not all of the above, only two of the above. And they detested those, but they had to know the material to get those questions right.
So, Charles, if you were back in the classroom today, you know, one way you could put a test together would be just simply to go to the test bank that is provided by the textbook company.
I would never do that.
Why wouldn't you do that?
I wouldn't do that because it's so stilted. And it doesn't give you any personal touch. And actually, I could tell where my students were in the exam because of the laughter. Believe me, I'm literally telling the truth. I could tell when they got to this point because there would be an outburst of laughter.
Everything I hear from you, I'm just hearing that you cared so much about teaching, about your students.
Oh, that was my life. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, literally. Seven to seven, 7 days a week.
7-7, yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever serve as chair or dean or interim chair?
I served as chair for 12 years.
12 years.
And
loved every minute of it.
Well, I didn't.
Okay.
But I had a charge, you know.
Sure.
As I indicated, we didn't really have a psych department. And I think Bonner would be pleased with how things turned out.
Charles, you became chair of the psychology department, if I'm not mistaken, 3 or 4 years after you were first hired at Furman.
That's correct.
Right? And you were chair thus in the formative years of what is now a modern, well-respected, rigorous department.
But when I came, it was anything but.
And so in those 12 years, what did you do, actually do, to make a difference?
Well, I threw out the curriculum and got a new one.
Okay.
That was the first thing. And once you do that, you hire people who also have those expectations. And you hire them, and then I actually instituted a 3-year review. And I would let psychologists know, you know, you're not going to get tenure. Go to another place where you don't have to tell them you didn't get tenure. And I think they respected me for that. They may not have liked the decision, but at least they realized that I was giving them that advice for their own benefit.
So do you feel like you got the right people on board then to do what you wanted to do?
Eventually, yeah. Or we wouldn't have kept them. And I think the reputation of the department, since I have left, would indicate that it has become a pretty good little department. Mm-hmm.
So you had high expectations for your students, high expectations for your department and for what you were trying to do, and excellence was a big deal to you.
High expectations for the journal as well, Teaching of Psychology, as noted by the rejection letters that we looked at earlier in this interview.
Yeah, so you wanted to go work for this department with Dr. Brewer.
Yeah, he was the one. Brewer was the one who really turned me around as a student. I took psychology because people had said Brewer was not to be missed. And it was only in that course, general psychology, where I began to really fall in love with academic psychology, scientific psychology, and eventually ended up being a major and taught elsewhere for 4 years after my degree. And when I finally applied to liberal arts colleges, Furman just happened to have a job, and Brewer was chair, and they were the first to interview me and the first to offer me a job, so They got me.
He's the only one we've ever done that for, too, by the way.
High praise.
I was asking John at breakfast, was that a little awkward to be an undergraduate and then come be a colleague? He said a little bit at first, but, you know, you get used to it. I mean, obviously the faculty knew what they were doing.
Yep.
And he knew what he was getting into as well. I wanted to ask you, Charles, do you have any favorite Brewerisms of your own? Do you have any? I mean, I see the ones on the wall, and I know a few of them. But do you have any all time favorites?
Things always take longer than they do, because that applies to everything you do.
Okay.
Some of the others are teacher specific, but that one applies to everybody all the time.
There's another one that I like particularly, and that is that everything is related. Can you finish that?
To everything else.
I've heard that one.
And the corollary is, and damn it, don't you forget it. That's the formal corollary.
What's the one about heredity? Isn't there one about...
Yeah. Heredity deals the cards. Environment plays the hand.
Thank you. Isn't that great?
And
awesome.
I think that's pretty good description.
Yes, it is.
Of heredity and environment.
That's you, right? You're not. That's not somebody else. That's you. All right. I want to give credit where credit is due.
It's unbelievable to me how many times I've heard these things floating around, and maybe never knew that they come back to you. And even I'm thinking about the young Rob thing, right? The young Rob story.
Or you've heard them from Jane Hallinan or Ken Keith or Sue France.
Or, you know, the Firm and Cheer. I was at the AP reading. People are doing this cheer. I had no idea the context of where this came from, and now I'm sitting in the room with the man.
Well, yeah, and I heard the Firm and Cheer at the AP reading when you're doing the Firm and Cheer, you know?
Well, it's still going on, just so you know.
Good.
And maybe Charles can repeat that Firm and Cheer in just a moment, but let me give a little background so that people will understand.
Right.
Furman University, for most of its history, was owned legally by the South Carolina Baptist Association. And it was always a conservative organization. Thus, Furman, for much of its career, was also conservative. But in the 20th century, became more of a nationally recognized school and a more liberal school in all kinds of ways. And it was during the time when there was a lot of tension between the conservative Baptist and a growing liberal faculty and students, when we had a university president who was quite a colorful character himself. His name was John Johns, and he oftentimes at football games would go down with the cheerleaders and give the Furman cheer. Charles, do you remember what that cheer is?
FU one time, FU two times, FU three times, and FU all the time. And it wasn't as funny to see John Johns do it because he was sort of a crusty character. What was impressive was to see Gordon Blackwell, the former president of Florida State, do it, because he was a very formal, and here he would be down there, FU three times all the time.
Isn't that great?
So good.
And so you can imagine at the AP reading, people are meeting Charles Brewer from Furman University, and you know the AP table leader, editor teaching of psychology, APA council, you know. And Charles gets up at night, you know, after dinner, and gives the Furman cheer. F you. I mean, it's lovely. It's that same thing, Charles. The theme for me that's been reinforced through this interview is that very professional, care deeply about the discipline, the content, the students, but you always found that way to be personable and kind and human, and that you let that funny, iconic part of you through in some way, shape, or form, which I really appreciate.
Play to your strengths,
and yet you did. And I'm gonna say to you what I said to Bill McKeachy last weekend, which is, I'm not the representative of teachers of psychology everywhere, but if I were for one moment, thank you, because you have done more than you know for teachers of psychology. The 12 years that you edited that journal and all those readers learned from those journal articles, and they became better teachers and they helped their students. So you directly, by editing, helped thousands of teachers help millions of students.
Well, that's very kind of you to
curricular
say so.
Issues that you helped. You not only as an external reviewer, but National Curriculum, St. Mary's, Puget Sound, those curriculum standards, national guidelines for high school teachers, the contributions that you have made to the teaching of psychology are remarkable and everlasting. And if I'm the representative of psychology for 10 seconds, thank you for all of us. Thank you.
It's been a swell ride.
Where are we in the teaching of psychology? Are we in a good place right now? Do you have a sense of what this trajectory has looked like?
It bothers me that we're becoming so mechanical. And I fear that this personal touch might decrease as a result of that. Mm-hmm. And I would regret that. And I think Batson would agree that if I had any specialty, it was that I could relate personally to the students. And if we just put it all on microphones and videos, then I think we will lose something.
Right. It's hard to write about those kinds of things.
Oh, indeed. It's almost impossible. You have to experience it. You can't write about it very intelligently.
Right. So I'm thinking about teacher training. If teachers can't see it being done, or if we lose this personal touch, this idea of learn who you are as a teacher, be authentic.
That's the critical point.
But if we are just going towards these are the methods, these are the evidence-based methods, it really does remove the person.
And I think that's unfortunate.
Well, there's a craft, and Bridget in her podcast talked about the craft, the artistry of teaching. I think she gets that from you, just like you got that from John Anderson.
Yep.
I think there's that lineage there of that there's a craft as in addition to the content, in addition to the pedagogy, there's that connection piece.
And we've talked to a lot of teachers, and it's striking to me how often it comes back to one teacher that they saw that inspired them.
Almost invariably, they can name the teacher, they can name the influence that teacher had them, and they realize they would not be the same teacher without that teacher.
Did you get a chance to tell John Anderson about his influence at some point?
As a matter of fact, I did.
Oh, good.
And this is sort of interesting. As I was sort of reflecting on things, I realized that I had not really thanked the people. So I actually made a trip to Arkansas.
Oh, good.
I talked to John Anderson. I talked to Phil Trapp. I talked to Don Kausler, all of my old mentors. And I like to think that it was a meaningful day for them. Because we seldom know it, but we don't say it. And I'm glad I said it.
Yeah. And obviously it was a meaningful day for you.
Oh, indeed, yes.
That, expressing that gratitude does a lot of good for everybody all around. Yeah.
Well, we appreciate you and your time. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much,
And
Charles.
Thank you for your service to the teaching of psychology.
I can't imagine it being better. It's been a swell ride.